welcome to another podcast recorded at the 5th Annual STEG Conference, held in the Economics Department of the University of Oxford. My name is Tim Phillips. STEG is a research initiative that aims to provide a better understanding of structural change, productivity, and growth in low- and middle-income countries. What do economists mean by slack in an economy, and why is it an important concept for development? Felix Sami Soliman of the University of Zurich and his co-authors have analysed firms in Kenya to find out by how much they underutilise labour and capital, and why. It seems there's a huge potential for development if we understand slack in the economies of low- and middle-income countries. But we'll get to that. I first asked Felix to explain exactly what slack is.
When we talk about slack, what economists really mean is that the firms in the economy, they're producing below their potential. Think of a firm with its labor and its machines. Slack is a situation when those machines and workers are sitting idle for part of the day, so they're being underutilized.
And in developing economies, in the normal run of things, do we find that there is a lot of slack?
Exactly. This is what me and my co-authors have shown. So we've collected data on capacity utilization across countries. And what's kind of striking is if you compare a low and middle income country like Kenya to one of the world's richest countries like the US, what you actually see is that the underutilization of resources is 20 percentage points lower in the US. So there's quite a gap there. And we thought that's sort of interesting because typically we think of slack as something that varies across time. So, you know, for example, in 2008, we had the big crash. And then we thought, okay, there's a lot of underutilization. So basically in bad times, we have a lot of slack. And in good times, there's less slack. We saw that this idea actually extends when we look across countries. Countries that are doing well, that are rich, they have less slack than countries that are poor.
In normal use, the word slack, it's pejorative. It implies laziness, not working hard enough. You're not doing it right. Is this true in the economic concept? Is that what it means?
We think it's sort of important to emphasize that slack is really a result of the economic choices that come together at a macroeconomic level. Obviously, in principle, it could be that it has something to do with our predisposition for work. But what we see over and over again when we look across countries is that once demand increases, the same kind of firms that previously had a lot of slack are now able to produce a lot more. So we really think that this predisposition for work or laziness is not really an important determinant of slack.
Which implies to me that if we can reduce the amount of slack that you have found across all of these countries, it might be a good route to development if we knew how to do that.
That's totally right. If you compare countries like Kenya to the US, in Kenya, there seems to be quite a lot more scope to increase production through increasing the utilization of resources. So that's totally right. But it's also important to realize that this slack as a source of development differences that has some limits. You know, the income differences between countries like Kenya and the US are like on the order of a factor of 10. Mm-hmm. And the differences in underutilization is like 20 percentage points. So it can only be a small part of that. But we think it's also important to understand the kind of policy space that these countries may have. So we, for example, know and show in this paper that if you have a lot of underutilization of resources, things like demand policy become highly effective. And that explains the policy options that low and middle income countries have and how they could use demand policy to increase their well-being.
So in this paper, you're documenting slack in Kenya. Now, I assume that you can't just observe slack directly. So what are you measuring here?
Yeah, totally. That was one of the big challenges we had to overcome. So there's sort of a very common and potentially naive approach where this is how we do it in, you know, the US and the UK and Western Europe, where we just go to firms and ask them, look at the number of workers you have, look at the number of machines you have, how much more could you be producing?
Ah, right.
Mm-hmm. And obviously that will really heavily rely on subjective assessment. And we do the same thing in Kenya and we get some interesting results based on that. But we also try to do a little bit better by actually bringing in measures that are based on direct observation. doing, where we ask the people that help us collect this data to really observe what these firms are doing and categorize the activities that they do throughout the day into productive versus non-productive. And based on that, we actually see that, for example, in rural Kenya, these sort of small micro enterprises, they're only engaged in productive activities for 50% of the time. Huh. And this is then not based on a subjective assessment of the owner, but this is based on a more objective measure. So what we would say is, yeah, Slack is a hard concept to measure, but we see consistent patterns across a range of different methods of eliciting that.
And what you've been able to measure, does this get us to a sort of stylized facts of Slack and where we're going to find it in the production process?
I think two things really stood out from this data that we collected and that we think like really speak to the sort of these cross-country patterns.
Uh-huh.
So the first one is that when we look at within Kenya, you know, Slack seems really heavily concentrated among the smallest of the firms there. And this is going to be important because, you know, when you compare how many small firms you have in Kenya versus how many small firms you have in other countries, in Kenya, there are like a lot of micro enterprises, a lot of like high street shops, and there are basically no big firms. So if you know that there's a lot of Slack in these small firms, this already goes some way towards explaining why there could be more Slack in poorer countries. And the second one is another important theme of development is that, you know, a lot of firms in developing countries are faced with a lot of transportation costs, geographic frictions, remoteness, bad roads, and that sort of thing. And to that theme, we find that Slack is much higher in firms that operate in more remote areas. So we think this, again, goes to this idea that developing countries are faced with a lot of transportation issues. And we then also find that within developing countries, especially those firms that operate in more remote locations, see more Slack.
And are there particular constraints for these firms that would give rise to Slack?
When we looked at those facts, my co-authors and I were really thinking, you know, what is the simplest explanation that could square up with the data? And what we came up with, or what seemed important, is that Slack is, you know, in these small firms. And that's why we argued that indivisibilities really play an important role in driving these patterns of Slack. So what do we mean by indivisibilities? You know, that already sounds like a mouthful. So what we have in mind is very simply that if you're a shop owner and you decide to open your shop, you may be faced with customers that you could serve in maybe 2 or 3 hours. What do you do in the remaining 5 hours? So we argue that the economy in these rural areas is such that in the remaining time, there is no real productive use for those 5 hours. So essentially that confines these shop owners to the enterprise and leads to a lot of idle time in the aggregate.
So having collected this information, you modeled this. And what does this indivisibility, which is really interesting concept, what does it tell us about how firms behave if demand increases?
We think this indivisibility creates this situation where we're going to have a lot of these small firms that are all operating subject to substantial amounts of idle time. If you have an extra 5 hours, if an additional 10 customers came by, or if your customers all of a sudden were richer because they have gotten some extra money, then you may very easily be able to cater to their demand without ordering additional inventory, without having to raise prices to essentially cope with this additional demand. And what does then mean in the aggregate is that faced with this indivisibility and the idle time it generates, these economies will be able to very flexibly absorb additional demand, just like in the way we think that during times of recession in Western countries, it's possible to increase output through additional demand.
Oh, this is good news.
Virtuous cycle can start here. So you have your customers that come in, they may be a little bit richer, you have the time to serve them. So then basically your profits will go up. So then you may in turn also be a little bit richer and you go to the next shop. And this is this virtuous Keynesian cycle that we're potentially used to from listening to politicians for their rationale of spending during recessions. But we really see these effects play out in the data. So this is what the sort of macroeconomic consequences of this underutilization. If, on the other hand, you were in a situation where there's really no underutilization of resources, then, you know, all you may really be faced with is the option to raise prices. And then it may actually be just inflation that you get from this additional demand.
I see it. So at the beginning, you've got a Slack multiplier almost, but then you get to the point where you can't do anything more. You're filled all the hours in your day. You raise your prices and that's inflation.
Yeah, and that's going to be critical because whenever demand increases, there's always a risk of inflation, and inflation leaves people vulnerable to like increasing prices of goods and services. And that's obviously an important issue to keep in mind.
Right. So you have evaluated this. You tested out your thinking by evaluating the impact of a transfer program in Kenya. What was the transfer program? What sort of transfers were being done and where?
Yeah, my co-authors, they carried out a unique large-scale experiment in Western Kenya where they were able to inject 15% of local GDP into a local economy. So this is sort of unprecedented for an experiment, and even also unprecedented for any kind of transfer policy. And they were able to use this to, you know, really test what are the aggregate implications of a huge increase in demand on these rural economies. And what they really, in essence, find is that these rural economies are able to absorb substantial amounts of additional demand without creating much inflation. So they find that the multiplier, this is this number that economists like to use, by how much does output increase for every dollar of additional demand that you put in, they find that this number is actually at 2.5. So you could think of this as like a policy that had very positive returns. And at the same time, it had very limited inflation, which was, as I said, key, because once you have this very low inflation, then you can be sure that also the people that didn't directly receive the cash, that they also benefited because they had money flow into their hands through economic interactions, but they weren't faced with increasing costs of goods.
One important thing I noted in the paper is you pre-registered your approach. What does this mean? Why did you do that?
We were faced with these findings, and they were kind of very impressive and to some extent puzzling. Uh-huh. And then we put forth one hypothesis that could potentially explain what is really driving things in the data. Mm-hmm. But there could be many other possible hypotheses that could be true. So what we ended up doing is we said, well, let's commit to this hypothesis and let's write down a simple model and let's write down a blueprint of how we're going to feed data into this model to generate quantitative predictions of what we actually get from our hypothesis. And what we then ended up doing is we just said, okay, we have committed to this. Let's do the work. Let's get those quantitative predictions and let's compare them to the data. And what the benefit of that is that we had essentially committed to something ex ante before seeing the kind of results that we get from this hypothesis. In theory, anything sounds plausible. So we committed to this before. And then we were able to compare it to the results of the experiment afterwards. And we think this makes things more credible, because if we hadn't committed before, there would always be the temptation to go back and add additional things to the model. Eventually, you can add so many things that you can explain anything. But if we had done that, the model would have become much less useful, because we had essentially added features that were just necessary to fit this particular context, but would have made the model probably less useful to use in other contexts.
So sort of high-risk approach, because you're staking everything on the fact that you think you're onto something here. Were you onto something when the results came in? Did it validate the model?
Totally. Like, I think there was some risk in doing this, but we think that the results really support this hypothesis that we had going in the sense that these indivisibilities that mean that firms are operating with idle time, they generate substantial amounts of slack, even in a quantitative way. And this leads to really big amplification of this demand influx through cash transfer. So in that sense, we think the model can really do a good job of describing what went on in the data. And why that's important is because, you know, once you have a model that was able to line up with this experimental evidence, that already gives the model a sort of stamp of approval. It makes the model more credible, and we can now go on to use this model to think about other kinds of cash transfers that you may want to do.
So what does this tell us about how effective cash grants on this scale could be?
I think the most important message of the paper is that it really confirms that cash transfers that are substantial in scale can be highly effective in raising well-being in these rural regions. So I think that's the most important message that I want to highlight here. But of course, you're always worried about what is the right scale? When is it too much? During COVID, there's ongoing debate about whether some Western governments put too much money into the economy, and this may have led to some of the inflation that we've seen recently. So I guess this concern also extends to cash transfer programs in rural regions. What is perhaps surprising is that we actually see that even for much larger cash transfer programs, our model still predicts pretty limited inflation and still large multipliers, which highlights the ability of these rural regions to absorb substantial amounts of demand.
Absolutely, because we spent the last couple of years worrying about COVID inflation in developed countries. But yet what you seem to have found is that the regions in which this kind of cash transfer might be useful, that's not really something we should be so worried about.
There are some caveats to what we said. So for example, we emphasize that there are a lot of features of this environment that make it uniquely able to absorb all of this additional demand.
Sure.
If we went to, for example, places that are more urban, so that are more connected, where there is less underutilization of resources, then, you know, our model also predicts that additional cash would be substantially more inflationary. And I think as we now see, even if multipliers still remain relatively high, I think inflation really is a severe concern because you will always have people that are not direct beneficiaries of certain government programs. And they then will really be left with the hard end of the stick where you're only faced with increasing prices of goods. And that I think should be like a substantial concern for policymakers. So when you talk about the different regions where these programs could be effective, you really have to think about to what extent are these regions able to absorb this additional demand.
We're always looking for some source for growth. Does this mean it might be possible that policy can engineer a transition out of a high slack equilibrium without creating inflation?
That's obviously a super intriguing possibility that I think at this point we don't have the full answer to. I think from what we can see in the data is that actually this influx of cash had a very durable effect 3 years after the cash was dispersed. So this is already, I think, a very positive sign that these cash transfers are not just like a straw fire, but they essentially create somewhat durable change. What are the longer run effects? I think the jury is still out. And obviously, it's also important to understand that there are inherent limitations to an approach that's just based on demand. Given these enormous differences in income across countries, it just must be true that other policies like increasing education levels, allowing bigger firms to operate more effectively in these areas, they obviously will also play a very important role.
Well, the stakes are high, but the potential rewards are high as well. This is a fascinating piece of research. I look forward to reading more about what you can do in the future. But Felix, for now, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Tim.
And that paper is called Slack and Economic Development. Authors Michael Walker, Nachiket Shah, Ted Miguel, Dennis Egger, Felix Sami Solomon and Tilman Graf.